This is episode number 823 with New York Times bestselling author Sam Harris. Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin. Ram Dass said, as we grow in our consciousness, there will be more compassion and more love. And then the barriers between people, between religions, and between nations will begin to fall. This is a powerful two-part series with Sam Harris, who is a five-time New York Times bestselling author, whose writing and public lectures cover a range of topics, including neuroscience, moral philosophy, religion, meditation practice, human violence, and rationality. His work has been published in more than 20 languages and has been discussed in the New York Times, Time Magazine, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. Sam has practiced meditation for more than 30 years and has studied with many Tibetan, Indian, Burmese, and Western meditation, and he created the Waking Up course for anyone who wants to learn to meditate in a modern scientific context. Sam also hosts the Making Sense podcast, which explores some of the most important questions about the human mind, society, and current events. And in this interview, we talk about how Sam discovered feeling unconditional love for all beings and what he did to maintain that feeling of unconditional love. The strong power of belief, which can make good people do horrible things. Deconstructing consciousness and using meditation as a tool for breaking the spell of our emotions. How to skillfully curate the contents of your thinking. This is a powerful part. The superpower of being indifferent to both good and bad thoughts and how to develop it. I'm telling you, I did not want to stop this interview. That's why we made it into two parts. I could have gone seven parts, but this first one is going to really open you up to thinking in a different way. And Sam has a different way of thinking. And part two is just as powerful, if not more, on the personal side of Sam, which he's never shared about these certain things anywhere publicly. So I'm excited for you to listen to both parts. Make sure to share this with a friend today. Text a friend and be a champion in their life by sending them some positive information. LewisHowes.com/823 to get the message out on social media, or just text a couple friends right now, individually or in a group chat. LewisHowes.com/823 or this link wherever you're listening to it on your podcast app.
I don't know about you, but when around 3 p.m. hits, I find myself craving the right refreshment to get me through that mid-afternoon slump. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea is full-flavored sweet tea, but without the sugar and the calories. It might take several bottles for you to believe that a delicious sweet tea can really have zero sugar and zero calories. But you know what they say, life is full of surprises. Or in this case, full of flavor. New Pure Leaf Zero Sugar Sweet Iced Tea. Try it to believe it. For 20% off your next 12-pack, head to Amazon and use promo code 20PureLeaf. That's promo code 20PureLeaf for 20% off. Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. Capella University's game-changing FlexPath format helps you learn at your own pace and fit earning a degree into your life. From before you enroll to after you graduate, you'll be supported by people who are invested in your success, so you can pursue your goals, knowing that help is available if you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Without further ado, guys, let's dive into this part one with Sam Harris. Welcome back, everyone, to the School of Greatness podcast. We've got the iconic and legendary Sam Harris in the house. Good to see you, sir.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being here. I've heard about you for many years, all incredible things, and I'm excited to dive into your whole life.
Let's start
from childhood. No, I'm just kidding. Now, you've been really known for meditation over the last few years more and more. From what I've heard from you, it's more about meditation. You've got this incredible app, the Waking Up app, and your voice is so soothing that it's very relaxing as well.
Or soporific, depending on.
Exactly. When did you get into meditation, and why did you feel like it was necessary for your life?
I was 18, and I had a drug experience with MDMA, and this is before MDMA was
getting cool.
I mean, I knew no one of my generation who had tried it or had even heard of it. I mean, I'm sure someone had, but it was this was 86, I think, 85, 86, and so, you know, raves, as far as I know, hadn't been invented, and it's, you know, and this was kind of an export from the psychotherapeutic community that had been using it for quite some time. And so it was given to me explicitly as a tool to explore the nature of consciousness and to realize something fundamental about, especially kind of relationships and my own emotional life. And I really didn't know what to expect, again, because I'd only known one person who had taken it. And so I sat down with my best friend, and we tried this drug, and it really amounted to a total firmware upgrade of my brain. I mean, it was just, you know, it's not, and again, I don't want to sound like a booster for psychedelics entirely. I mean, there are downsides to all these drugs. I think MDMA in particular stands a chance of being somewhat neurotoxic. You know, the data at least is ambiguous on that. People can have bad experiences, certainly on LSD and psilocybin, and I've had those experiences. And so it's a mixed message. And I have a chapter in my book, Waking Up, titled Drugs and the Meaning of Life. And there's actually an audio version of that on my podcast. It might even be the first podcast. So if people want the full story there, they can get it. But the reality for me was that this, and this is true for many people, MDMA showed me a landscape of mind and a way of being that I didn't realize was possible. You know, I was an 18-year-old who was very egocentric, and, you know, my ego was well defended, and you know, I had no, you know, the notion of experiencing unconditional love had not occurred to me, and, you know, and there's just many things that I just was not. If you'd asked me what was someone like Jesus talking about, and what's the core of all of the religions that people take so seriously, the experiential core of it, I think I had just an empty file on that. I just had no sense of, you know, what people had been doing for the last 2,000 years to transform their experience. So I had this experience of, you know, unconditional love is not too strong a word. And
so during this experience, you felt unconditional love.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I mean, what I felt was layers of self-concern there that I didn't even know existed get stripped away. And what was left was a state of being that was just wide open and had as its ethical core just unlimited good intention toward other people, whether they're friends or strangers. And I realized that I loved strangers in the same way that I loved friends and family at the most basic level, because I just wanted everyone to be happy. And that desire was so... It was just turned up to 11. You realize that's, if the real ballast for you emotionally and ethically is that you want other people to be happy, you want them to have beautiful lives, you want them to be, to realize their dreams, you want their, you basically, you realize that there's the sense that there's a zero-sum contest between your well-being or your happiness and others is an illusion, right? I mean, you want all boats to rise with some tide.
Win-win experience with everyone, yeah.
So you want positive-sum interactions with people. That was, it just bowled over every other wrinkle in my mind for the period of, you know, 4 hours, right? So there was no limit to that, and it's not transactional. You realize that that is actually a state of being. That's the way that could be the default state of your own consciousness if you could only locate it, you know. And then coming down from an experience like that, you know, the drug wears off and then you're returned to who you used to be with the memory of what it was like a few hours before. So that then there was an imperative to figure out what was possible in terms of techniques like meditation or new understandings of how the mind works. I mean, there's clearly a path. There must be a path by which one can have that experience more and more of the time.
Sure.
And so then my notion of just what the goal of meditation was, I mean, that has actually changed a bit. It's not about producing this state of unconditional love all the time. I mean, I think that's not actually the center of the bullseye, but that was the first experience I had, which gave me a sense that there's a path and there's something to do.
Did you ever feel like you had a sense of unconditional love before that moment?
Oh, no. I mean, I had no reference point.
No reference.
I mean, I had love for, I love my mom, right? Like, love was a noun that I could use, honestly. But no, there was no, I mean, there hadn't been a glimmer of that experience, really.
Wow.
I mean, it was actually the first moment in my life that I felt sane. And I hadn't realized
that. At 18.
Yeah. No, I mean, and it was only by comparison to all previous states. I mean, I had this experience and I realized, okay, this is sanity. Right, like
this is how it should be.
Yeah. And the return to one's normal waking, narcissistic, neurotic consciousness was one of not being restored. One problem is that we have this word drug that is the word we use to cover this vast class of compounds that are psychoactive, and some drugs are awful and not worth taking and just intrinsically bad for you, both in terms of what they do to you neurophysiologically and the kinds of states of consciousness that people experience there. And other drugs, I would argue, have immense therapeutic value and are worth taking under the right conditions. And MDMA is certainly one of those drugs, and it's being used as a remedy for PTSD now in a lot of research to great effect. But people think, oh, you've taken a drug, so this, by definition, this is artificial. So whatever you experience there is less like the real you than whatever returns when the drug wears off, right? But that wasn't the experience, and that's certainly not the experience as you get deeper into things like meditation that don't entail drugs, right? That you can actually discover that the way you're tending to be, the way you've been conditioned to be by life and biology, frankly. I mean, we're not. Evolution has not designed us to maximize our well-being. Evolution has designed us to be fairly paranoid.
Mm-hmm. To try to stay safe, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ourselves.
We're apes, right?
Right.
This is not about our happiness. From the gene's eye view of what we're doing here is not, maximizing human happiness and building a global civilization that will endure for a million years, right? That's just not what our genes care about.
They care about being safe or?
Well, they care about, all we've evolved to do is maximize the likelihood that we will successfully spawn and stay around long enough to see that our progeny survive and spawn. Once you're 40 years old, evolution doesn't care about you, for the most part. I mean,
right.
I guess there's some argument that grandparents are of value or even great-grandparents are of value, but it can't see so much of what we need to be happy. We're deeply conditioned for tribal violence, right? And tribal violence is something that we obviously have to outgrow, globally speaking. We're deeply conditioned to perceive ourselves in at least potentially hostile relationships with all other apes like ourselves. And yet the self, the feeling of self, and this is actually getting closer to what I think the goal of meditation is, the sense of self is an illusion, right? This is a construct that can be felt through and discovered to actually be false. There is an immense amount of good that comes with that discovery, but it's not something that has paid adaptive dividends in the past, and it's something that, it might actually be hostile to what would keep an ape, safe, for the millions of years we and our ancestors have evolved, right? So there are many good things, and I would argue most good things that we want to be able to pay attention to in the year 2019, and that we want to have the free attention to explore would be counterproductive if, you know, you were returned to the savannah mm-hmm. and just in a contest of all against all. You know?
Right.
So, I mean, everything from, I mean, conversations like this. I mean, we're going to talk about almost nothing that apes like ourselves have needed to focus on for 500,000 years.
When did we start to focus on the desire to be happy? What year or years or decades was this where we really said, okay, we've got our needs met or basic needs met. Let's focus on being happy and feeling unconditional love more.
Well, it depends who you're talking about because most of humanity, even at this moment, doesn't have the free attention to really think seriously about what it means to be happy. Well, you just look at the economic imperatives of, you know, most people in most situations. It's not about really having the free attention to do whatever you want or what you would think at the end of the day would be most satisfying.
It's right? About survival more,
yeah.
Basic needs.
Yeah, yeah. And or just you're living in a situation of stark political insecurity, right?
Right?
You're just worried about, you know, what sort of violence may happen in the street later today, or like what you may or may not say that could get you jailed, right? You
know, crazy.
So it's nuts. So like so much of human history has been just figuring out how to get strangers to cooperate reliably enough so that they have the free attention to explore the things we want to explore, so that yeah, we can figure out why we're dying from diseases and then, you know, cancel them, right? So
right.
like just to be able to do science is a luxury. And this is where, I mean, you know, as you probably know, I've spent a lot of time criticizing organized religion because historically and even currently, so much of it is hostile to, I mean, so much of it is putting in place of real curiosity and a real search for answers, Iron Age fictions that just got codified in books mm-hmm. that can't be edited. Right, so in my view, the main tool we have to navigate now, and this has always been the case, but it's just more and more imperative that we realize this, the main tool is human conversation. And what every religion is an insistence by a certain group of people that we anchor ourselves to a conversation that was held hundreds or thousands of years ago. Right. So
and
so it's like either you want to have the best ideas actionable and interpretable now, or you want to be hostage to what your great 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 grandfather and grandmother thought was true about the nature of reality. And if you go back far enough, you're talking to people who knew absolutely nothing that a sixth grader knows today.
Right.
You know, I mean, literally, if you could build a time machine and send a sixth grader back 1,000 years, that boy or girl would be the smartest and wisest person on earth.
In the world.
On so many topics, right? I mean, just to know that electricity exists, right? You're a savant, right? So, or the DNA has something to do with biological inheritance. Or,
right.
or the germ theory of disease. I mean, imagine being the lone person on earth who understood that, you know, you should wash your hands before you deliver babies.
You save the world.
Yeah, exactly.
You save humanity from that, yeah.
So it's insane that we are captive to doctrines that just we're never in contact with the knowledge base that we have currently.
Why do so many people believe so strongly in their religion? And I'm not here to say someone's right or wrong, but why do they believe
I
so
strongly? That's why I
okay,
am.
Okay, you can do what you want to say. Why do so many people, I mean, there's billions of people that still believe in religion, that have a religion, and that believe so firmly in the beliefs of the books from their religion, yet they can't prove any of those things from those books. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Can't prove
they certainly can't prove those things.
Certain
yes.
things actually happened in certain books.
Right.
Except for just that someone wrote a story about it.
Yeah, I mean, some imagine that they have proof, but I mean, it's often.
There's no actual physical proof today that these things happen.
No, and I mean, it's worse still. The books themselves say that they're inerrant, right? I mean, the Quran says that it's inerrant, and the Bible says that it's inerrant in various places. And that is taken as evidence of its inerrancy. Well, I mean, the Lord of the Rings Tolkien could have put a line in there which said this is, you know, perfectly true, and any doubt otherwise would get you consigned to hell. And that wouldn't prove that the book is true. So it's just, you know, it doesn't. And the amazing thing is that, you know, every Christian looks at the Quran and looks at the whole discourse around it within Islam and finds it completely unpersuasive, you know, and every Muslim returns the favor with respect to Christianity. So it's not, if you stand outside of one of these traditions, you can see that the language game that they're playing within it to justify everything is illegitimate. But in defense of religious people, it's true that there are these core needs in life, emotionally and socially, that secular culture has been very slow to meet, and in certain cases has almost nothing to say, especially with respect to the kinds of experiences we started this conversation on. I mean, it's just like the experience of self-transcendence or the experience of unconditional love. If you have that experience, if you wake up tomorrow morning feeling unconditional love for all sentient beings, right, you traditionally, there has been no language with which to greet that epiphany, but religious language. I mean, so if you go into a church and say, listen, I've just had this experience, they have a lot to tell you about, you know, Jesus and his grace
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's gotta be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
One of my favorite parts about my job is that I get the opportunity to travel a lot. And in fact, I'm recording this right now while I'm in Mexico. And actually, I was thinking about something that I wanted to share because I get a lot of questions from so many people about different side hustle ideas. So here's one for those of you out there that are on the go a lot like I am or traveling a lot. When you're staying in your Airbnb on your trips, have you ever thought about how you could be making extra money by hosting through Airbnb while your home is vacant? If you're interested in an extra stream of income, Airbnb hosting is an easy place to start, and it's like giving your home some company while you're away. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. You can't always trust your gut, like those times when it tells you to have that extra piece of cake or when it tells you to skip your morning routine and sleep in another few hours. Probiotics can't help with most of your gut decisions, but if your gut needs a little support, Ritual has your back. They made a 3-in-1 supplement with clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. Ritual invested in a study modeling the human colon, which showed their symbiotic Plus significantly increased microbial diversity and the growth of beneficial bacteria. Rigorously tested and validated by a third party for allergens, microbes, and heavy metals, Ritual multivitamins are vegan, non-GMO project verified, gluten and major allergen free, certified B Corp, and made traceable. Personally, I love Ritual's Symbiotic Plus because it keeps my gut feeling balanced and is super convenient. There's no more shame in your gut game. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide your insides. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/greatness. Start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/greatness for 25% off.
The power of prayer, and it links up with 2,000 years seeking experiences of that kind in a contemplative context, you know, monks and nuns. And I mean, if you go too far, then they begin to worry that you're too heterodox. And if, you know, in the 14th century, if you went too far, you know, they would burn you at the stake because you're claiming to be God yourself, or you're claiming to be the equivalent of Jesus, right? So there's a hierarchy there that you have to respect. And the same is true for Islam. Yeah, I mean, so there is a baby in the bathwater that religious people are right to worry is being disregarded or being thrown out. When you criticize faith and criticize these doctrines. The other reason that religion endures, and it's really the main one, is that, you know, we all die, and the people we love die, and that is intolerable. And it's true that if you can believe a sufficiently consoling story about what death means or what it doesn't mean, a lot of the stress of life goes away.
Gives you more peace.
Yeah, I mean, in certain cases, total peace. I mean, in certain cases, if you believe the sufficient doctrines, it's a good thing. I mean, you can literally get yourself into a situation as it often happens under Islam, where a mother can legitimately celebrate the, you know, the suicide bombing perpetrated by her jihadist son.
She knows she'll see it.
Because she knows he got into paradise as a martyr, and he got the whole family in there too, right? This is like, you know,
it's the ultimate sacrifice.
Yeah, and it's all good. I mean, if you really believe it, it's all good. Nothing has gone wrong there.
Right.
And so that's the power of belief, and that's what, you know, it's the insidious power of belief, because it's the thing that, I mean, something like suicide bombing should be impossible. It should be impossible to convince somebody to do that, right? It should be synonymous with severe depression and just inability to find any goodness in life. That's not the kind of person who becomes a jihadist and becomes a suicide bomber. These are not the, you know, depressed people who would otherwise be, you know, medicated in a mental hospital because their depression is so severe. No, these are people who have a lot to live for the most part. You know, they're disproportionately well-educated. These are people who are, you know, come out of engineering programs and colleges. They can get jobs. There's economic opportunity. They have sincere beliefs in this case, martyrdom and the reality of paradise. So, yeah. So I've spent a lot of time, you know, worrying out loud about the consequences of those kinds of ideas, because for me, the most concerning thing about our world is not that there are a lot of bad people doing bad things. It's a lot of good people doing bad things under the sway of unfounded and dangerous and divisive beliefs. Right. I mean, ideas are way more powerful than, you know, the 1% of us or the half of 1% of us who just happen to be psychopaths.
Right. Because if you put a belief in, it's like Inception. It's like you planted an idea so deeply in someone's mind that this is going to happen. They believe it so much that they're willing to do whatever it takes to make it a reality. Yeah. I'm curious, what do you believe happens when we die?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that would require that we understand exactly how consciousness arises, and we don't understand that yet. There's certainly good reason to doubt that you, as you experience yourself most of the time, as a, you know, the English-speaking person who or subject who has the episodic memories you have of your life, that entity floats off the brain and goes elsewhere, right? And that's the expectation that most people have who believe in souls, right? And when you hear people use so-called near-death experiences to justify a belief in an afterlife, it's that kind of arithmetic that's being done. They say, well, I was, you know, I saw myself in a tunnel of light, or I rose up off the table that they were performing surgery on me. I could see myself. But then I realized I was, you know, not connected to my body. And then I, you know, and then there's some story about how they, you know, met entities or met members of their own family who had died, you know, and they're, you know, so if you can recognize your grandma and still understand English and then still have a memory of the life you're leaving, all of those are modes of cognition that we know a fair amount about at the level of the brain now, and we know they can be disrupted piecemeal in life, right? You know that we know that if you get a stroke, or if you go into the lab and they do TMS on you, transcranial magnetic stimulation, they can interrupt certain functions, which really are no longer there anymore, just because that neural real estate has been perturbed. So the proposition here is that, you know, if you interrupt one part of neuronal function, you lose, let's say, your capacity to understand English, right? Mm-hmm. But if you destroy the brain at death, everything about yourself that's familiar persists, right? That doesn't make a lot of sense. We know a lot about mind being dependent on the brain. You know, any function you could point to in yourself. You know, vision.
Mind versus brain, what's the difference?
Well, I mean, the mind on some basic level is what the brain is doing. And if the brain stops doing that, it's reasonable to expect that the functions of mind will stop. But consciousness is the fact that it's like something to be associated with that information processing. And that is still fundamentally mysterious. I mean, there's a lot that our brain is doing that seems unconscious, right? And seems unavailable to consciousness in principle. I mean, so like, and so, and it's, these unconscious processes are delivering the contents of consciousness in each moment, right? So you and I are having a conversation. I can see you. I can hear you.
Right.
I can, you know, there are things that are stable that I can inspect because they're among the contents of consciousness. But how all of this stuff is showing up is being unconsciously mediated and really can't be inspected. So, right. You know, like the example I always use is, you know, because I'm always talking when I have to use an example, but so like, to some degree, however imperfectly, I am managing to follow the rules of English grammar without knowing how I do that.
Sure.
Right? And you're able to effortlessly
listen,
interpret.
Listen, understand, yeah.
Yeah, so, and in fact, you don't even have a choice. If I say the word pigeon, right, you can understand it. I mean, provided you're a native English speaker and that's right. In your vocabulary. You can't help but understand it. You can't, it's like you can't say, well, whatever that next word is going to be, I'm just going to block the semantics of it. No, the semantics right. just come in, right? Because, and so you're doing all of this, your brain is doing all of this unconsciously. And you can't get to a place where you are standing upstream of the parsing of the sounds I'm making. I'm just making a bunch of small mouth noises, right? And I mean, and you know the difference when you're in the presence of someone who's speaking a language which you know not a single word, right? You know, whatever that is, Thai, say, it just sounds like pure gibberish. And the surprising thing there is that it's very hard to even imagine that anyone can decode those sounds and extract meaning at all, right? It just sounds like, well, it's amazing that that's a language, right? And yet, once you know the language, you can't help but decode it. So all of that's unconscious. And yet, the fundamental mystery of our being and the most important thing in the universe, really, I would argue the only important thing in the universe is the fact that the lights are on in and as what we are here subjectively, which is consciousness. You know, if the lights were off, right, if it was all just, if there was no distinction between biological systems and this table, right, you know, if there was nothing that it was like to be you, and there could never become something that it was like to be you or any other physical system, well, then there's no important distinction between the wet stuff we have in our heads and rocks and, you know the water and the ocean. I mean, it's all just stuff that can have no interests. It can't suffer. It can't experience happiness. It can't be deprived of happiness. It can't be creative. So the good thing about this universe is consciousness. And so and the thing we can care about, you know, your life is as your consciousness is in each moment. And I mean, all you have is your experience and your possible experiences. And that's the core of our morality too. It's we are in a position with one another where we can affect each other's states of well-being and our opportunities to experience further well-being in the future. And that matters. Our conversation around that is our conversation around morality and ethics and you know, politics and, you know, so.
How do we unlock our consciousness or expand it in a positive way? Besides meditation, obviously, but how can we think differently so we can unlock this consciousness for ourselves?
Yeah, well, there are many levels at which to do that. I mean, so meditation is, there are many different kinds of meditation, but the kind that interests me most and which I most recommend is, it often goes by the name of mindfulness now. Mm-hmm. I mean, mindfulness is very widespread, but there's a sort of trivial versions of mindfulness and there's the deeper version. And the deeper version is really to understand the mechanics of your own mental suffering.
Sure.
And put yourself in a position to cease to suffer unnecessarily, right? So you notice that you're lost in thought almost every moment of your life, and much of your thinking has this mediocre character of causing you to worry about the future and regret the past. Mm-hmm. And just feel a baseline dis-ease with life, right? Whether it is just, you know, what it was like for me to drive here in traffic and like, oh, am I going to be late? You know, I was supposed to be here at 10 o'clock. And so so much of our life is the steady hum of that kind of thinking, right? And not to mention the bigger concerns about, you know, disease and, you know, whether your child is sick. And like we're thinking, like we're plunged into thought in each moment and we don't notice it. Mm. And until you learn to be mindful, you can't notice it. You might have this abstract idea that, yeah, of course I'm thinking a lot of the time, but, you know, so what? Or like, what's the alternative, right? There is no alternative. You're just, each thought will arise and completely capture your attention. And then you are hostage to the emotional and behavioral imperatives of that thought, right? So, and it's necessary to some degree to be that way, because we need thought. I mean, we thought is the way we organize our lives and form plans and understand what's happening, right? So like it's almost everything that makes us human is born of our capacity for abstract thought and planning and goal formation and all the rest. But it's possible to recognize thought as a stream of appearances in consciousness, and to recognize that consciousness is the prior condition of their arising. And when you can do that, you can actually break the link between thought and psychological suffering. So if the thought is an anxiety producing thought, you can notice this whole process where a thought arises and you feel anxious, and that feeling of anxiety in your body, once uninspected, begins to generate the motive for further thoughts along those lines. So you're thinking about the thing that makes you anxious, and because you're anxious, you're finding the anxiety intolerable. You've got resistance to feeling this feeling, and you're thinking about, like, how can I get out of this? And like, okay, clearly I've got to change here. Let me get it. You know, I'm going to start writing some things down on a checklist. You're thinking without knowing that you're thinking, and you're feeling the motive force of this emotion. But once you can become mindful, which is to just be aware of what's arising in consciousness without judgment, without reaction, without resistance, right? I mean, so to be able to notice anxiety as just a pattern of sensation in the body, right? And then when you can do that, you can see that, first of all, it's not that bad, right? Right. In fact,
you're not dying.
Yeah, no, and under a different framing, it's a sensation that is often pleasant, right? Like the excitement you feel, or even the anxiety you feel before you get on a roller coaster, right? If that's your thing, is something you're willing to pay to do, right? Like you want this thing. That's part of the experience.
You go skydiving.
Yeah, whatever. The thrill is a thrill because you felt some of that, right? So. And that's why I say there are other levels at which you can work with the contents of consciousness so as to cease to be unhappy. I mean, and one is to change the frame around an experience like that. So I mean, to recognize that anxiety, you know, the anxiety you might feel before going out on stage in front of 1,000 people, just the raw sensation in your torso and in your face, I mean, just the physiology of
tenseness,
it.
That
is importantly similar to something that can have a positive frame, which you seek out, like excitement. I mean, a much more extreme case of this is like you can, when you think of what the physical sensations are when you're working out, and you know, working out as hard as you can work out, and in the most satisfying way, precisely the workout you'll feel good for having done. The actual sensations can be extremely unpleasant, and if they just came upon you in a different context, you would call 911, you'd be absolutely terrified, right?
Like I'm sweating profusely, my muscles are ripping,
So it's just the conceptual frame around experience does a tremendous amount. But mindfulness is a more basic ability to notice this mechanism of becoming identified with thought and resisting certain emotions and mood states, and being able to just unlock from all of that and recognize that consciousness itself, that which is simply aware of experience, is not actually changed by its contents. I mean, so like that which is aware of joy is the same thing that which is aware of sadness, right? And on some level, it's not diminished by sadness or improved by joy. And you keep dropping back into that state. And I mean, paradoxically and happily, that state begins to have its own kind of qualitative character, which is more toward the good side of things. I mean, it's more joyful and compassionate and loving and positive. And it's because the antithesis of all those states is what is happening, is being kindled by our entanglement with thought and mm-hmm. reactivity. It's the resistance to, you know, I feel the sensations of anxiety, say, because I was lost in thought about how, you know, afraid of failure I am a moment ago. I can break that spell with mindfulness and then notice that the physiology, which still may take a few seconds to dissipate, yeah. is fine, right? Like it's fine to feel that way. It's like it has no more meaning in that moment than a pain in the knee or indigestion or something, which is you completely can contextualize and it has no implication for who you are as a person, right? Like you don't feel pain in the knee and abstract from those unpleasant sensations back upon yourself and think, I'm such a fucking schmuck, right? Like, well, who am I? How did I become this person? But people with anxiety, you know, if you've got stage fright, right? You're going out on stage and you feel nerves. That the potential for self-judgment, the potential to read into that mere peripheral display of sensation, that you're this person who didn't work out, right? You know, in the end, people fall into that hole again and again, right? And it's not just sort of unnecessary; it's completely unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And you know, mindfulness is a tool that would allow you to discover that.
Yeah, if you could wave a magic wand or set the parameters for how you wanted to think each day, the thoughts that you actually came in your mind, and you could control it. I'm assuming you control them in a lot of your own ways with your own strategies and techniques and awareness. But if you could just say, I'm sick of trying to control it or reframing things when they come up, and you could just say, I want to think these thoughts every day, what would you want to think? What type of thoughts would you want to think? And what would you want to eliminate?
First, more fundamentally, I'd want to recognize that the mind has no shame. It just thinks. It just thinks, yeah. Right? So like the thoughts just keep coming. And the goal from a meditative point of view, and this is an analogy that's used in Tibetan Buddhism, is to get into a position where thoughts are like thieves entering an empty house. Right, so there's just no possible problem.
Can't
right?
steal anything.
Yeah, there's just nothing to steal.
That's right? interesting.
So to truly be indifferent to between a good thought and a bad thought, that's the real superpower.
That is cool.
So that's the kind of the more fundamental level of addressing the problem. But it's also true that you can skillfully kind of curate the contents of your thinking and think better thoughts deliberately. And you can think more creative thoughts, you can think more compassionate thoughts, ethical thoughts. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in many, many things. I want to know more about many, many things. I want to be right more often than I'm wrong. I mean, all of that's happening at the level of the conversation you're having with yourself and other people and with good books. Yeah, I mean, there are philosophies like, you know, the Western philosophy of Stoicism, you know, like the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. There's so many good thoughts, you know, that if you were looking for a script that would generate a reliable baseline of psychological well-being and ethical conduct, that's certainly part of the script. I mean, to be able to think, and again, it comes back down to reframing a lot. So like if, you know, again, to make it trivial, you're driving in traffic and, you know, someone cuts you off. The natural state, sort of the road rage state, is to be irate, you know, and to essentially hate that person.
Right.
You know, the person whose face you can't even see. I mean, you can't even tell whether the person's 90 years old or 20 years old, right? And that should matter to you, right? Like you should have a different feeling about a 90-year-old than a 20-year-old in that moment, given the implications. But a stoical kind of reframing of that would be to recognize you don't know what is going on in this person's life, right? And 9 times out of 10, if you could know it, you would feel compassion for what's going on there. And you'd feel gratitude that you're not suffering the same problem. I mean, the one reframing I use all the time now is that whenever something bad is happening, or something, you know, quote bad, something that is causing me stress is happening, I think of all of the worst things that are not happening, and I just think of how much I would pay, you know, literally pay, to get back to the situation, precisely the circumstance I'm now in, that I'm now stressing about.
If you had worse conditions.
Yeah, yeah, right. So, like, just...
If you had no legs, if you could, you were
exactly,
sick.
Exactly. Like,
when you get a new car or a new home, your first reaction might be to say things like, oh yeah, or I can't believe it, or booyah. But what you really want to say is the one thing that can get you the help you need. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm is there with the coverage you need for your car, your home, and even boats, motorcycles, RVs, and other things that matter to you. With a State Farm agent, you know someone is there to help you choose the coverage you need. With so many coverage options, it feels good knowing you can find what fits for you. And when you need ways to get help, State Farm gives you options there too, in person or on the phone with your local agent, or on statefarm.com, where their award-winning app State Farm lets you do things your way. So when you need help protecting the things that matter most, remember to say, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. The carb fear is real these days. But why does it feel like the carb-heavy foods are what we tend to love the most? After years of wishing there was a better go-to option when the carb craving hits, I finally discovered Hero Bread. Hero Bread makes those same delicious bready favorites free of consequences or compromises. They've remade carby, empty-calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. The soft, fluffy experience you love when enjoying a refreshing BLT, savory breakfast burrito, or mouth-watering cheeseburger. There's something for every craving, including sliced bread loaves, buns, and tortillas. And they have monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the 2-gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1-gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Hero Bread looks, feels, and tastes just like any other bread you'd get at the grocery store, which is exactly what I was hoping for. Their white sliced bread is so good, and every time I make a sandwich with it, I can't believe something that tastes this good is actually adding extra protein to my meal. Don't give up on being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co. Note, it's not .com. And use code greatness at checkout. Again, that's greatness at hero, H-E-R-O.co.
You find out, you know, I did not find out today that I have a brain tumor, right? So whatever I was stressing about today, if I got the call that I have a brain tumor, right, how much would I pay to get back into precisely the situation where I was just stressing about, you know, whatever it was on my schedule or, some hassle? Everything is a non-issue until it's a real issue. And then, when you take something that's a real issue, like a brain tumor, then the question is, how much of the day are you going to spend having a brain tumor? Right? I mean, being busy having a brain
tumor.
Suffering
about the brain
tumor. Exactly.
Yeah.
And suffering about your uncertainty about the future, right? So there's a time course to all of this. So, mm-hmm. At each point, and this is where, worry is almost always pointless, because in each moment, there's either something you can do to solve a problem or there isn't, right? Now, if there is something to do, well, then just do that thing, right? Solve the problem, right? If there isn't, there's actually nothing to worry about. The worry adds nothing to that situation, right? So if you have a brain tumor, yes, you need to go from one doctor to a second doctor for a second opinion, and you find the surgeon you want. And there's a whole process. You're going to get an MRI, all of it. You're having to deal with a lot of, yes, objectively stressful things. But, big picture, we're all in this situation. Life itself is a brain tumor.
We're all going to die.
We're all going to go on this. We're going to get the full tour. Now, for some of us, some of us will be very lucky and it will be very orderly and free of pain and we'll be surrounded by everyone we love.
100 years old.
Yeah, it's just going to go perfectly. And for some people, it'll be chaotic and terrifying and short or long. It's every permutation. And I'm not denying that it's rational to have preferences there, right? You do want the orderly, loving,
right.
And not untimely unraveling of it all rather than the opposite. But whatever is happening, you have this moment and then you're thinking. And you're thinking about the future and you're thinking about the past is the mechanism by which you will truly suffer in each moment. Because it is, in fact, true to say that even physical pain is something around which you can develop an impressive ability to be equanimous, right? And we also have, for extreme pain, we have painkillers. I mean, like, happily, we're not living in, you know, 1700, where, you know, someone is just kind of sawing off your limb, suffering, you know, after the leeches didn't work. So, you know, 99% of our suffering around everything, even objectively horrible things like brain tumors, is our thought about past and future, is the regret. And it, I mean, it's the story we're telling ourselves.
How do we move on from the story, or how do you do it? Do you live with a lot of worry each day, or are you so good now at just saying, this doesn't matter, you know, this is in the past, or I'm concerned about something that's not gonna happen potentially in the future, so let me get back to present. Like, how do you not worry? Well,
there you have it, my friends. I hope you enjoyed this episode, powerful one, on mindfulness versus happiness with Sam Harris. What a game changer. We are just getting started. Part two is coming very soon. So if this is your first time here on the podcast, hit that subscribe button, leave us a review, let me know what you thought about this. We like to share out these reviews online. We like to share out these reviews in our internal team to see how we can improve this show, how we can make it better for you every single day. And please spread the message of greatness. Be a hero in someone's life by sending them this link. Just copy and paste the link on your podcast app, wherever you're listening to it, Apple Podcast or Google Play or Stitcher or SoundCloud, wherever you're listening to this podcast. Copy the link and text it to one or two friends right now. Post it on social media. Share the message of greatness and be a champion and a hero in someone's life today. Paying it forward is the best thing you can do. And as our friend Ram Dass says in the beginning of this episode, as we grow in our consciousness, there will be more compassion and more love. And then the barriers between people, between religions, and between nations will begin to fall. Look within yourself today and ask yourself, where can I be more compassionate? Where can I have more love? I know I can tap into this in so many areas of my life, in my relationships, in family relationships, business relationships, and with myself, to be honest. Where can you have more compassion and more love? You know, you want to have compassion. You don't want to be walked all over in your life, but you want to make sure you're coming from a place of love and compassion. It's a daily practice and a reminder. It's not easy, especially as you continue to rise, especially as you continue to grow. You will be faced with more challenges. And that's why this episode and the next episode is going to be so powerful for you now and in the future. I love you so very much. And you know what time it is. It's time to go out there and do something great.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta, because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members, because at Delta, we know. Refill? Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
At Metro, get an iPhone 12 with 5G and a dual camera system for $99.99. Take amazing pictures and share them instantly. And don't put up with life's yada yada.
Yada yada.
Like photo bombers. Zoom, crop out,
yada yada,
and bye.
You don't take yada yada in life, don't take yada yada from your wireless provider. Get iPhone 12 with 5G with no activation fees and nada yada yada. Only at Metro by T-Mobile. Switch to Metro, bring your ID. This offer isn't available for customers currently at T-Mobile or that have been with Metro in the past 180 days.
We'll be right back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, I don't know about you, but the more I prioritize taking care of myself, the longer my social battery can last throughout the day. And it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves way too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. But therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain or exhaust your battery. Now, what's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time, that introverted time. Therapy can help you get clear on this. And if you're thinking of getting started on your mental health journey, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to fit your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Lewis today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/L-E-W-I-S.